Hi, my name is Paul Smart, and this is the Harvest Edition of the Work Show. Story's Farm in Kiskatom, Greene County, is located at the junction of Routes 23A and 32. It's been around for generations and is one of the more popular farm stands in the region. We caught up with Jimmy Story, who, with his brother Matt, now runs the farm.
So 1890, or 1890s, you said?
Yeah, 1896 or 97, somewhere around there. Before that, they farmed up in Freehold.
Okay. Oh, so it's the same family with the
as a Stories Nursery? Yes. There's no Stories to speak of left up there now. They've sold that business, but.
And so did everybody in the family always work within the farm, or did people some work and some moved on to other things?
Well, I'm sure that, I don't know about other generations. I'm sure there was ones that left the farm and went to do other things or started other farms. My dad was in a family of, five, yeah. And he was the only one that stayed on the farm. I mean, his father was killed when he was real young, so that was a little different circumstances, too.
Was that hunting accident thing?
Yeah, he was shot when he was deer hunting, when my dad was in his early teens.
Oh, God.
So, my father was the oldest son, so he more or less was the one that a lot of the things fell on his shoulders.
Uh-huh. And so when did you first start... Like, what's your first memory of working on the farm? What were the first things you did?
Pulling weeds. Mm-hmm. My father would give us a little spot that we had to keep the weeds out, or picking strawberries in the spring, and picking peas, whatever needed to be done. Helping in the barn. We all had our own chores in the barn, which calves we had to take care of and what we had to do. I have five brothers and sisters, so... There was lots of chores for all of us. My brother, who's older, not 2 years older than I am, he's on the farm. And we're the two boys. And then my four sisters are in the general locale, and they help us out all the time. But they're not really, per se, a part of the... They are a part of the farm, but not... But, my brother and I, Matt and I, were the ones that run it.
How big is the farm now? Or how?
We farm is just under 1,000 acres, and we own 90% of that. We rent probably about 100 acres.
How does your season work?
You mean as far as our growing season?
Yeah.
Because we have the dairy, so that's year-round. That's 365 days a year. So
How many?
We're milking about 45 now. And we start the greenhouses up usually around the beginning of March, end of February, beginning of March. We start the greenhouses up to get the plants started. And then we go from there. It just depends on the weather, if it's an early spring or late spring. Or this year we got started a little earlier because things were so nice early. That's not always a good thing either.
And then how late does it go?
Well, it goes, we're extremely busy up till we have a real heavy frost. Then once we have that heavy frost, then things slow down because we're not able, all the soft crops, tomatoes, peppers, things like that. They get killed off with the frost, so those are we don't have to harvest them anymore. But we'll harvest potatoes. We grow quite a few potatoes. We put them in storage, so we'll start we're doing it by now, but since it's so wet, we haven't been able to get started. But we'll usually start digging them for storage around now, and we're usually done by Halloween, hopefully. Mm-hmm. And then once we get that done, then we start harvesting the grain corn that we feed the cows. And that's probably a 2 or 3 week thing, and then things really slow down. We can take a little breather.
Uh-huh. And so what's involved with the breather? Is it just a real breather, or you still have the dairy?
Oh, yeah, we still have the dairy, and we still have potatoes we that we pack out for, different grocery stores and other customers, wholesale customers, and... we're still packing squash out, the hard squashes, but by a breather I mean it's and we're still milking the cows, of course, but it's not like somebody's standing over us waiting for us to deliver something that next day, next hour or whatever the day. Well, we'd like to sell as much as we can through the retail here, through the farm stand, so we try to market as much as we can, but anything extra that we have, then we sell wholesale. Well, wholesale is a whole different ball game. It's the guys are really cutthroat, and you're dealing with pennies all the time, and it's hardly worth it for us to do that.
And the milk?
Well, the milk is, we're just paid a certain price. Whatever the price is, that's what we're paid. Uh-huh. And, some years are really good with milk, and some years, you're you're losing money, but that's just something that's always been on the farm, and so we're just, it's a routine, we're used to doing that, and
it just works out for us. Was it a larger enterprise at some point? Were there, what was the maximum number of cows you all were?
No, right now we're probably at the maximum that we've ever had. We probably, right now we're probably maxed out for the facilities that we have. Mm-hmm. We'd probably be better off if we had 30 or 35, but just... last year we had a tough year with the flood, and so we milked a few more cows just to pay the bills.
Yeah.
And we've kept them on, so we'll see from now. We might cut them back again, but last year just, you know, we were lucky that we had the dairy because the milk price was halfway decent, and we were able to, we had some extra heifers that we were able to put on the string to milk, so...
And how does it work in terms of your hiring, like, at, you know, for help? How does that fluctuate during the seasons?
Well, during, you know, when we start planting and start, or first thing we usually start picking is asparagus and strawberries. When we're doing that, then that's when we start needing a lot of help, or more help, I should say. But we have enough going on through the winter with the cows and... we sell firewood and packing potatoes that we have four guys that Mexican migrants that have been with us now for a few years, and we try to keep them busy all year round just so we have them when we need them.
Mm-hmm.
And one gentleman who was with us for about 15 years, he went home last year and hopes to come back again this year at some point, but he wanted to go home and spend a year at home, so... most of the guys stick with us year-round. And then I have two sons that work full-time with us, and my nephew, who's my brother's son, works with us full-time. And then a lot of my sister's children all help us out, so we have a big network of family members that really help us. Mm-hmm. And then we have some local kids. I have a couple of nephews that help us and a couple other kids.
How do you have to formalize, like, the pay and that employment thing? Has that all changed over time?
Well, they don't make it any easier, that's for sure. There's always something new they're coming up with that, you know, more paperwork that
do
I don't
handle
think,
the paperwork? Is that
with the employees, I do a lot of it. And my mom, too. My mom does a lot of the book work, but I try to do more and more of it, but... Uh-huh. As much as she wants to do, I let her do. Or I can get her to do, I should say.
And how's that employment situation changed since when you were a kid? I mean, was there as much migrant at that point, or was it?
Well, there probably was, but there's just a lot more regulations now on different things that you have to, paperwork that you have to have at hand in case you're audited, you know, and... just I don't think we're doing anything different. It's just you have to, everything has to be accounted for. Everything is, you know, written, has to be written down and taken care of. Otherwise, you know, there's somebody that's looking to make sure you didn't do something wrong, you know.
Then how does it do you ever get a sense of how it pays out for yourself or for your brother or for the kids, or is it just constantly looking at the income and the outgoing, keeping the cash flow moving?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, you know, you hope at the end of the year you have enough that you're setting aside something so that when you, I don't know if we'll ever retire, but if we wanted to, that we'd have some kind of a nest egg there, or if something, you know, some kind of health problem. You know, that's the biggest thing now is trying to just. You can't afford not to have health care, but you can't hardly afford to have it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, that's the big thing now, you know, what that costs every month just to cover the few people that we do.
Do you do like a, like through a state, or do you have like a regular kind of health plan, or are you doing the...
No, we have it right through a regular insurance company that we pay by, you know.
And then you have to pay workman's comp and all of that sort of?
Yeah, keep track of all that stuff, yeah.
And
unemployment, where, you know, we haven't ever laid, the whole time the farm's been in business, never laid anybody off, and we have to pay unemployment insurance.
Yeah.
So, you know, if somebody leaves, they leave on their own account. It's not, you know, You know, the part-time help that we have in the summer, they don't work long enough that they can collect anything on it anyway, but they still have to pay on it.
And do you get vacations away?
We try to.
Where do you like to go when you get away?
Oh, it doesn't matter. Anywhere. Anywhere. Uh-huh. You know, just to get away, even if it's for a day, you know.
Uh-huh. When you were growing up, were there more farms coming up the 32 corridor or up through this area? Or was?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There was, you know, a lot more, well, I think it's kind of turned around now. I think there's a lot of small operations where they're getting started, you know, and trying to get going. But there was a heck of a lot more dairies through the county. You know, this area right through here, I don't know if there was a lot more, probably not, but there was more, you know, but when you look at the county as a whole, there was considerable more.
And when did the farm stand start up here?
This one, my dad, well, they always sold, they always grew vegetables and sold them. My grandmother used to sell them off the front step of the house, but my dad put the farm stand over here on this side of the road, oh, late 50s, I believe.
Uh-huh. And that's, and so then you started picking up the whole stream of people going along.
Yeah, well, you know, at that time the game farm was open, so there was a big draw of people going by. And probably more traffic now, but it's different traffic, you know. A lot of these people now, I think, have homes up here, mm-hmm. and they're staying, you know, for most of the summers. And
has there been a change in what people want in terms of their vegetables and products?
Yeah, I'm sure there is. I mean, that changes from year to year. You know, it just depends on what's the hot item on the food channel. You know, somebody says something, and then, you know, that's what everybody is looking for.
So that means, are you watching the food channel or just listening to the customer?
Well, we're listening to the customer mostly, you know. You know, we have a pretty stable thing of items that we grow, and every year we might grow something different or a couple things different that we think some people might want. But we don't get too exotic.
Mm. You know. Now, how does your day work, or how does the
well, I don't know, start in the morning and milk cows. You get up around 5:30 and come down to milk. They meet the guys here at 6, and most of the time they're going to pick corn this time of year. Mm-hmm. And depending on how much corn they got to pick, that takes up a few hours of the day, 3-4 hours. Mm-hmm. And then they go from there. It just depends on what. It's pretty much a routine. The guys, the workers will go and they'll start picking the garden stuff. And, you know, depending on certain things need to be picked every day or some things are every other day. So, and it's, you know.
And go to about what time?
Oh, we like to have that stuff done by lunchtime, you know. And then in the afternoon, we just go after things that we need to have picked that aren't the real staples or something, you know. Mm-hmm. We got to go dig potatoes, or if we have to, somebody else wants, you know, who knows? You know, we got to do some hoeing, you know, do some weeding or something like that.
And did you ever think of doing anything else?
Well, when I was real young, I did.
Yeah? What was that?
What was it? Well, I don't know, anything but this. Uh-huh. But then as I got older, I couldn't see myself doing anything else, so.
And what are the best parts of it? As a kind of an ongoing...
Probably just working with family members and watching, you know, working shoulder to shoulder with my sons and my daughter, you know, watching them grow up and having that kind of an influence on them. This time of year, everybody starts to get a little tired and worn out. Days are getting shorter, so you can't get as much done, you know. You have all these things all night long you think about that you're going to get done the next day, and the days are so short that... just not enough light anymore. Mm-hmm. And so you really start to look forward to the first real hard frost, so there's not so many things to do.
That's good.
Corn in the fields, and listen to the rice when the wind blows across the water. King harvest is surely come. She's so good to me, and I'm bound to come out on top. That's where she said I should be. I will hear trees in the meadow. King harvest is surely come. A dry summer didn't come before.
Chris and Randy Loken bought what became Love Apple Farm in West Ghent, Columbia County, back in 1969. This past month, they sold their farm to the Greenberger family of Art O' My fame and are moving off to Burbank, California, where they will be pushing a new film that the couple has made.
We got in this and then realized after we bought it, and my husband was thinking, oh, this is great, I can write, you know, good share of the year and farm the rest of the time, but of course we both discovered that wasn't the way it was. And because it had another farm, farmer had picked it up, Old Tailings actually down the road had picked it up at a sale, and so they were taking, you take the crop this year because it was already into the harvest, and so we didn't have to do anything in the way of that farming that winter, that fall and winter. But then come spring, of course, it was like, okay. So we hired, you know, he had hired airplanes to spray the orchard and such, and then soon realized that that was economically not a very good way to go. So he really had to start, you know, hunkering down and learning about farming, and met with local farmers, and Bartolotta's became good friends and really were very helpful. And he read a lot of books and went to a lot of meetings and learned a lot.
When was this that you bought the place?
It was in 69 acres. But what we've done in the way of expanding is cleared, you know, a lot of land, and, you know, there was wooded areas, and we took that out and planted more trees, put in trickle irrigation throughout the orchard, and underground tile drainage ditches, created, you know, the pond that you see out here, the big pond by the house. There was originally a pond way in the back, which is still there. Then, you know, planted lots of the semi-dwarf trees, which were just, you know, becoming popular then. And also forgot to mention this, but we ran the farm totally organically in those days. So Chris also did a lot of reading about growing fruit and vegetables organically.
Now, that was new.
That was very new, yeah. We were locally, we were considered to be the farm. People would go by and they would be, oh, that's the farm with the worms in their apples, you know, because we were organic and they didn't know much about it. But originally we just had, my husband trucked to, they had 68 health food stores and spas that he trucked to with our organic fruit. We had peaches then also, peaches and I think there were some plums, I'm trying to remember now, but mainly peaches and apples. And then he also grew some vegetables, cleared some land and planted some vegetables. So, but he was trucking with the peaches and the apples, and I think we had some pear trees too, the fruits to these various locations.
And how far would you truck to? Where was your?
A lot of them were in as far as Boston, but a lot were in Manhattan, and he didn't have any free time to write it. I mean, very little, let's say, very little.
And how did you go about finding help during that time?
Well, at that time, we did hire, in the beginning, we did hire local people. But it was a real, real struggle keeping. And then because, of course, we were organic, we had a lot of people, like even coming out of the city, the people that really knew about organic farming and were, it was kind of that hippie period. Mm-hmm. Where, in fact, it was very much that. But they, so we had people that wanted to work that were, but they were not, well, let's say, real productive, and it was a struggle. And then we had, oh my gosh, I could go on with some tales from that period of some of the things that took place.
Did they stay on? Did you have housing?
No, we didn't, but there were some that actually pitched a tent. There were some of those, one or two that actually came and like so wanted to work the land that they pitched tents and would stay there. But it was an interesting period. So then my husband will know that exactly when it was that we started to then get the Jamaicans in, and that's when it worked much better. And then we built the building. You know, it was a little bit different than the big building that you see as you drive in now, the steel frame building, and we built on the back side of it a camp for that would house 6 men. So we got Jamaicans in, and they were wonderful. We used to have to go down and pick them up. And then ultimately, of course, we switched over from the Jamaicans to the Mexicans, and the Mexicans have been wonderful as well.
You've talked about doing the organic as if it was something in the past. Was there a shift there?
There was a shift because we actually continued, Chris actually continued to clear more land, plant more trees, just become bigger, and it got more and more difficult to do the organic methods with as much as we were growing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when he started to switch over. But even to this day, because of the knowledge of all of the organic days, you know, he still uses, well, we use a low spray program and still uses some of the natural organic materials. Along with, so it's kind of a combination, along with those that he feels are safe and in moderation. And as I said, he's always used a low spray program too. And the tree ripe concept, that was his originally. He was the very first one who came up with, that was our logo, you know, Love Apple Farm, famous for tree ripe fruit.
Okay.
And now you see tree ripe everywhere. In your supermarkets, like,
And
So it sounds like it was easy getting to know everybody up there. Or was there a period of standoffishness?
Oh, there was a lot of curiosity. I mean, like, we would hear through the grapevine, like, oh, those are the people that, you know, she's a model and he's an actor-writer. And so they were a little suspicious. And they gave us, I think we had heard through the grapevine, they had given us 6 months. Mm-hmm. And then we'd be out of here. And we had funny tales, like in the early days. I remember that first winter that we bought the farm. It was, we had tremendous amount of snow and blizzards and such. And I would, at that time, I was taking Amtrak to go in and out of New York. And I had to get to, you know, I had a modeling assignment. I had to get into New York City, and we have this. So it was, so Chris... and we couldn't get, that's right, and the car wouldn't start. It was so cold. So he said, you drive the tractor, and I'll get in the car, because he knew how to just, like, you know, press on the gas when you need it or whatever. So I should get in the tractor, drive it, and pull, you know, going down this hill here to get it started. So we did. In the meantime, I'm all dressed for New York City, and I had a white Mongolian long, you know, coat and kind of Cossack white Mongolian hat and whatever, and I'm sitting on the tractor driving, and Chris is in the car, and we roll down the hill, and it, which takes us to get the car going right past our neighbors down here, Joyce and Herb Engel, and they were at, you know, their breakfast table right by a window looking out, and they told us afterward, they said, my gosh, now we've seen everything. And then the tales of, you know, so, you know, a lot of stories like that. And when I would go into model, and soon after we had the farm also, Chris, being a farm boy from Wisconsin, said, well, you know, we're going to raise our own meat as well here organically for our own consumption. So we had a few pigs, we had a cow, a goat, and, you know, whatever, a couple of sheep. We kind of built on that. And I remember one time, you know, a story with the goats and having to milk the goats before, you know, milk the goat because Chris got sick the night before I went into the city and such. And they would love the tales when I'd get into the city and I'd be working in on set. And the photographers would go, okay, Randy, what happened, you know, over this weekend?
This is around the time the Green Acres is
born. Exactly. And so we were like, that's what we were. We were like Green Acres.
And, How many people did you all, or do you employ here? Or how does it work seasonally over the year?
We still have pretty much like six, I think, in the orchard of the migrant workers. I mean, as many as six. And then we have a family that live here year-round, a husband and wife who have, they have five children, but one daughter has already moved out of the house. And they're all, even the young boys, you know, pick berries in the summertime and do some jobs around, you know, that they love to do. But they basically, the husband and wife, and the husband in the winter months prunes in the orchard, and we hire locally another couple Mexicans that live locally that come in and help him with the pruning in the winter until, say, March, and then in March we get, again, the migrants. Actually, they're H-2A workers. H-2A workers that come in. Right?
What's that?
That we're at the point of how many people that we employ here, and I'm talking about the Mexicans that we have in that house. So they leave. As soon as the harvest is over, they leave, and then just it's just the one couple that live on the houses here around, and they watch things that go on in the wintertime. They take care of things. And then in the stand, of course, we have the wife, Leticia, works in the bakery, and she pretty much heads that up. When she first came, she didn't even know what a pie was. So I taught her how to make pies and cookies and breads, and so all of those things. She
were you
heads
working
up the
from
bakery.
A family memory, or
from family recipes, from my family, from Chris's family, and yeah. So we opened the bakery, and then we have employees that work, you know, out front on the pick your own station, one inside on the inside register, and then on weekends we have more people that come in.
And
in the back we have packers. You know, we have somebody that packs out the fruit. for the stand, and then also we have for when we have to pack for wholesale, which we have a lot of that too, then we have more people.
How many skills have you had to employ from the beginning, you know, jumping into this as a lifestyle change in 1969, but there must have been a lot of just learning as things were happening, and scurrying from one thing to another.
You're absolutely right. It was trial by error, and I made plenty of errors. But over a period of time, I come to know the business, and as you can see, we have created a rather nice place, and I think I became a pretty good fruit grower.
Your usual day with all of this, when does it start and when does it end?
Particularly in the early days, it was daylight to dark, 7 days a week. Now, of course, as we got bigger and more successful and I had better employees and they each had their place, then it became somewhat more manageable. But I've always been a seven-day-a-week owner and operator. And I'm not a great sleeper to start with, so our day actually starts at 7 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And ends 6 or 7, depending on what we're doing. And there are times when you do things at night, depending on what's needed. You don't run the farm. The farm runs you. It's an old saying, but it's absolutely the fact. Particularly when you have as many perishables as we grow. I don't know if Randy was telling you, but we grow a lot of berries and lots of stone fruit and things of that nature. So we're harvesting every day from the day we start picking berries until the last apple is picked.
You grew up on a farm, right?
Yes.
Did you ever think growing up on a farm that you'd be back on a farm?
Never. I'm one of 8 children, and I was certainly considered the least likely to end up on a farm.
And are you the only one that has?
Yes. In my case, I think, I once wrote that I don't think we've evolved to the point of where our body is merely something to carry our head around. I like to both lives, the physical and the intellectual. And I wanted to raise a family outside of the city. And Randy was modeling and I write, so it didn't really matter so much as long as we had the proximity to New York. And we bought this farm thinking when she retired we'd move west. Well, we're still here.
Oh, now you're finally moving west.
Yes, we are.
Yes. It took a while.
What are you going to miss most from here? Or does it just look like straightforward in a new direction?
I know I will miss the land. I mean, we'll never have another farm.
Well, I am going back full bore to a life that I led prior to owning this farm. In a sense, although I don't begrudge any of the time we've been here, in a sense it has been a bit of a detour for me. And I look forward, frankly, to not having the business responsibilities. The land, I love land, and I like to grow things. The business itself, I will not miss at all.
Mm-hmm.
And look forward very much to being able to write with a totally free mind. It's difficult to try to balance both.
Ah!
director of Rural Migrant Ministry, which is based in outside of Poughkeepsie, but works with the rural and migrant farm workers communities throughout the Hudson Valley, the Catskills, and Western New York.
Our name, our official name is Mid-Hudson Catskill Rural Migrant Ministry. There's no and, but we're known as Rural and Migrant Ministry, ampersand, not and, so it's RMM, Rural and Migrant Ministry.
And how did, when did you all come into being, and how?
We came into being, I believe, about 30 years ago. We just celebrated our 30th anniversary last year. There were a group of people here in the Mid-Hudson Catskill Valley who knew of the migrant farm workers who came into the area and then left, and also knew of the rural poor who worked here and never left. And they decided to do something for them in terms of welcoming them to the community. I believe there were five denominations who got together in a covenant to support the migrant farm workers and their children and their families.
Is that how the organization is still funded, through that covenant?
Each of the denominations, yes, who started, and they have been more, have been added, they support, the congregations themselves support Rural Migrant Ministry, individuals in the congregation support Rural Migrant Ministry, and then we do grant writing and special events, and we send out appeals.
And what are some of the programs that you run?
Our mission is to address the needs of the rural poor, including migrant farm workers and their families, with a primary focus on developing leadership skills for youth and for farm workers. Our formal mission is we work for the creation of a just rural New York State by nurturing leadership, standing with the disenfranchised, especially farm workers and rural workers, and changing unjust systems and structures. We do this mainly through three program areas. One of them is youth empowerment. The other one is called accompaniment, which is standing with the farm workers as they struggle to make change. And the other one is education, where we just educate the community to the issues that are facing the farm workers and their families.
And is that working one-on-one or with classes? Or?
The youth empowerment programs right now are split up into three different areas. One is the youth arts group, and that's run by Andres Chamorro, who's an artist. That's been running for about 15 years. It's youth-led, youth-run. And they go out into the community, they make art for social change. So they've put out a CD to counter some of the hip-hop that's out there. They've worked in the schools to change the cafeteria food. They take on farm worker justice issues. They go out to Albany and they meet with legislators to describe what goes on in the community and to see if they can make change that way. They went out 2 years ago and interviewed farm workers in the areas and translated them, and put out a book called Migrant Stories. They've also made a video. The other part of it is the youth education group, and they are youth economic education group. They're out in Sullivan County. They've gotten together to learn how to start their own business because of the depressed economic situation out in Sullivan County. A lot of kids don't have jobs, and they don't have dreams of getting jobs or of going to college. So this group got together. They educate the kids about businesses, and they've actually started their own cooperative within the last 2 years. They're selling what they call basement bags, which are bags that they buy from a co-op in Mexico, I believe, a women-run co-op in Mexico. They they put designs on them, they tie-dye them, they print them, and they sell them. And all the money now is going back into it. And through a youth economic program out in Sullivan County, they were able to hire the youth and pay them over the summer to do the work that they do. So two of our children there have gone on to college, have graduated from high school and gone on to college.
Okay.
In our youth arts group, about 95% of the kids who have gone through the youth arts group have gone on to college. this past June, we had 5 graduate from high school and go on to college. So we're really, really excited about that. The other part of the Youth Empowerment Group is the summer programs. One of them is a 1 week over leadership camp, and we have 3 2-week day programs that happen around. One happens in Lyons, one happens in Marlboro, or closer to Newburgh. We've had them in Pine Plains. So depending on how much support we get from the community, that's how we're able to move the camps.
How many migrant workers and just rural workers are there in the area?
It's difficult to quantify because you have a certain population that does not migrate, and then you have a certain part of the population that does migrate. And the following the harvest is from New York to Texas to Florida, back to New York to Texas to Florida. So that's difficult too. But the migrant education programs, the federal programs, they're able to track because they have a tracking system for the kids, so the kids don't lose out on education credits as they're moving. And that's one way that you can track the populations, actually. As a measure through our summer leadership camps and our day camps, that the populations are maybe 40% Latino, some type of either Mexican or Central American. 40% are African American or Black from Caribbean countries. And about 20% are regular European American white people. Mm-hmm. So that's basically how, through our summer camps, we can say that that would be the population, and not exactly how that would fit if you went statewide.
And what are the challenges of this, that these workers are facing on a regular basis?
Through our Justice for Farm Workers campaign, I can tell you that the workers are denied a day of rest, overtime pay, and they're denied the right to bargain collectively without fear of losing their jobs. They've been excluded from the labor laws of New York State, and that goes back way down to the 1930s. But we've been helping them to fight to change the laws in order to bring them in under the same laws that other workers have.
Are there many families within this population and children?
Many families, many children.
And how are they welcomed into local schools?
There's a migrant education program in SUNY New Paltz who would be able to answer questions about the kids more than we could. I was a tutor for them at one point in time, I'd say maybe 15 years ago, which is how I got involved in rural and migrant ministry, because I'm also a translator, interpreter. So I was doing interpreting for a lot of groups, and rural migrant ministry was one of them. And eventually, when they needed a managing director, I applied for the position. A lot of the schools in the area already know the kids who come back. If they're the migrant farm worker children, they come back year after year. Mm-hmm. And they've made an effort to welcome the kids and their families by having fiestas when they come in, or having a goodbye, you know, harvest fiesta. Like I said, the federal government tracks them, so they have a record of who's coming and who's leaving and who's graduated and who's not graduated, etc. So I'll tell you, it's sad, and it's difficult, and it's dangerous for some of our workers. Not all migrant workers are undocumented workers. Many are workers who've done this type of work for generations in their families. Their grandparents did it, their parents did it, the kids are doing it, they're doing it. They're very proud. They do it well. So they are not part of this undocumented worker group, but there is a part of it that is an undocumented worker group. Unfortunately, when anybody hears anything about migrants, they assume that they're illegal immigrants, and so they have a lot of people have a negative connotation toward that, obviously, in our political climate, like you said. So it tends to get difficult in terms of fundraising. I mean, you really have to have a social justice bent in order to be able to see beyond documentation. And thankfully, those are our supporters, people who have real firm belief in social justice.
When workers move from harvest to move around, how do they tend to do that? I mean, is it Does it become regular over a period of time? You spend a certain time, amount of time, or a season here and a season there and a season there, and you become part of that community?
I mean, if I'm not mistaken, those people are known as true migrants because they do follow the harvest and they move. The true migrants under the migrant education program move from school district to school district in order to do agricultural work. So they're known as true migrants. There are other people, I suppose, who move, but not to look for that kind of work. And then there are people who settle permanently, more or less, in areas such as Middletown or Newburgh, where they have an industrial base to support that kind of work.
And so there's a lot of moving from one job to another. And is it all at minimum wage or below minimum wage? Or?
Well, a few years ago, the law was changed to tie the wages of the farm workers to the federal minimum wage. So I would say that the majority of farmers take that fairly seriously. And then there's a group that doesn't. So that's why we try to make it so that everybody has to follow the same law, and that way you don't have to depend on somebody being a nice guy or nice or not a nice guy or a nice woman or not a nice woman.
What have you gained working here? And
what have I gained? I'm Latina by birth. I was born in Brooklyn. My mother's from Puerto Rico. My father's from Cuba. So, and I'm bilingual. I'm an interpreter. My first language was Spanish. I just have, I think, a natural affinity toward populations, minority populations that need a little bit more than others, tend to be poorer, etc. I have a more difficult time with education. I suppose I've just gained an area where I can put my education and my resources, my abilities to use to help other people. And it's like I said, we're not a direct service organization, so we're not feeding the homeless and we're not, you know, providing blankets, but we're helping, it's funny, most of our dinners are called Sowing Seeds of Justice, and what I think that we do, and I think the Reverend Witt would agree, is that we put seeds down with the young people so that they are able to know that there is a future for them, something different than. They're not excluded, they're included, they have a voice, they have something to contribute, they gain confidence, they gain leadership skills, and it changes their lives. It changes their lives, the lives of their siblings, their families. They have a sense of pride and self-confidence. It's just an amazing thing to see.
Awake and I'm asleep.
Hi, I'm Paul Smart, and this has been the October issue of The Work Show, Harvest. Music this month included Chants d'Auvergne by Cantaloupe, as sung by Victoria de Los Angeles. You heard the band doing King Harvest Has Surely Come off of their eponymous second album. We heard Mira Stanke, the Harvest song, by the Bulgarian State Television Women's Choir off of the album The Mysterious Voices of Bulgaria. And finally, we heard Michael Hurley doing Wildegeese's off of the great Woodstock-made album Ida Kant Snak. Until next month, this is The Work Show.